Hello again. I'm Grant Reher, director of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School and host of the Campbell Conversations. You're about to hear the first in a new series of debates on significant and provocative public issues. This debate was recorded at the Everson Museum before a packed Hosmer Auditorium on February 1st. The question before the audience, and now before you, is whether we should increase taxes on the wealthy. This question has been front and center in debates on the budget, fairness in the economy, and the proper role for government, and has been conducted at all levels of government and in terms of all forms of taxation. The issue figures to be a centerpiece in the presidential and congressional elections this November. A bit of a backstory for the series. The idea for the venture came out of a program I direct in the summers in London on politics and media in Britain. For 6 years, I've taken my students to Oxford to hear an Oxford Union debate. And for a while, I've wanted to recreate an American-friendly version of them here, but in the community and not just at the university. This debate on taxing the wealthy is our first effort. It was sponsored by the Campbell Public Affairs Institute with contributing support from the Maxwell School Alumni Association. The debate was made possible by the generosity of the panelists who donated their time to participate and by the hard work of the staff of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute, in particular, Bethany Wallowender, Kelly Coleman, and Ben Lingaman. Not enough of these kinds of debates happen in the United States. For all of our political conflict, we don't do debate very well. This debate is an attempt to address that problem. Briefly, here are the structure and the ground rules for what you're about to hear. In the first hour, two teams of three panelists will make their case. Individual speakers for each team will take alternating turns. Speakers can say what they planned in advance or can react to what they've heard. Then in the second hour, they will engage each other in response and rebuttal, after which the audience weighs in with questions and comments. The event ends with brief closing statements, and then the audience members vote on the proposition by walking out one of two doors, as they do at the Oxford Union and in legislative assemblies around the world. The debaters, in the order in which they will speak, are Jennifer Hamlin Navias from May Memorial Unitarian Universalist Church in Syracuse, Deborah Warner from Center State CEO, also in Syracuse, Len Berman from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University, New York State Senator John D. Francisco, former New York Governor and Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, and Kevin Hassett from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. The debate is moderated by me. The question before this House, should we increase taxes on the wealthy? We now begin with Jennifer Hamlin Navias speaking in the affirmative.
When we live out of that sense of gratitude for what our history and heritage has given us, we are at our best. When we are grateful for what we have, we are a generous people with a vision of this world being a better place. So let us start with this thought. Flawed as we are, worried as we might be, we have much to be thankful for, and we still have much to give to one another. Let us live out of a vision of generosity, not a vision of scarcity. It is the larger vision, making each one of us and this world a better place. Our American culture is made up of a diversity that is lavish in its breadth. Diverse as we are, much of our cultural and moral values come from our Judeo-Christian roots. Our sense of justice and righteousness as a people has been deeply shaped by those teachings. I am Christian, and so to be authentic, I am speaking from that tradition. However, this does not discount or diminish other faiths or belief systems. In the Bible, righteousness generally means something like conforming to the laws, doing what is right. Righteousness and justice go together. Justice, in the biblical sense, is much more than retribution. It is not simply that if you do wrong, you get punished. Rather, justice is closely related to love and grace. It thus provides vindication, deliverance, and a creation of community. The focus of justice is upon the oppressed, with particular attention given to specific groups, such as the poor, widows, fatherless, and those with physical infirmities. Justice is associated with the basic requirements of life in community. This is our moral history. This vision, this understanding is what will make us a better, stronger people. Over and over again in the moral code that our Judeo-Christian history and scriptures give us, there is particular attention paid to those who have little, who are vulnerable, the poor, the widow, the child. It is clear that this, our moral code, that it is not each person for themselves, but rather each person as part of the larger community. In Leviticus 22:23, it is written, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the alien." This is the God in which we trust, the God that calls us to take care, to share what we have with those who have so much less, the God who calls us to remember not to hoard our riches unto ourselves, but rather remember that all of what we have is ultimately a bounty, not completely of our own doing. The fact that we are not an aggregate of individuals hell-bent on beating everyone else out of what they have means that we must and do have the value of justice. Justice balances our imperfections. We may know that we must take care of one another, but that does not always mean that we do what we know is right. Sacred scriptures know this. They were not written in a vacuum. There is and always has been a recognition that we as humans are flawed, imperfect. We desire and we strive to be better, to be righteous, but we know that we will fall short. And so there is justice. We are called over and over again to seek justice, to do justice, to create justice. These values are part of our moral roots, our moral heritage. Let them be our guide. In a just world, each person does not keep all that they have to themselves. We are each called to look out for one another, and not simply our mothers, our fathers, siblings, children, or extended family. We are called to care for all. In the New Testament times, there was no word for progressive tax. But what better support of a progressive tax than these words of Jesus? To whomever much is given, much will be required. Increasing taxes on the wealthy is not simply right, it is necessary. If justice is to abound in this country of ours, and I believe that it can, we must live up to fulfilling our obligations to the more vulnerable. We must actually fully fund our schools adequately so that all our children have access to decent education. We must actually fully fund emergency food programs so that all children have access to food. Think for a moment of all the different parts of our country that make the accumulation of great wealth possible. Public education, the patent system, the court system that allows for enforceable contracts, the interstate road system that allows for transportation of goods, protection against crime and threats from outside of our country, and that list can go on. When we pay taxes, we are taking care of our own. We are supporting the infrastructure that allows us to be this amazingly productive, positive, hopeful people, leaders of the world. None of us has the right to acquire as much wealth as we can, regardless of the cost to all others. Some of us may have that ability, but that does not make it a right. But what we do have is an obligation to keep this country as great as it has been, if not greater. We have an obligation to steward our infrastructure so that it is there in the future for our children and our children's children and their children. There is a social contract at work, and to quote Elizabeth Warren, the underlying social contract is that you take a hunk of your wealth and pay forward for the next kid who is coming along. My learned colleagues will give you facts and numbers that are important to understanding the practical reasons why the progressive tax is right. But this question is not simply an economic one or a political one. It is also a moral one. The progressive tax is right, it is necessary, it is just.
You're listening to the Campbell Debates on WRVO. The question is whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. Now speaking against the proposition is Deborah Warner, Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations at Center State CEO in Syracuse.
My colleagues and I are taking the position in opposition to the proposal to increase taxes on the wealthy. This generic proposition gives rise to many questions. These are problematic questions that need to be answered in considering increasing taxes on the wealthy. Who is rich? Is it someone who earns $200,000 a year? That's the threshold that was in effect in New York until December 31st of this year. In New York, 76% of the people who paid the millionaire's tax were not millionaires. Is it $500,000 a year per household? President Obama's new proposal starts a higher surcharge at that level. At the center of this idea is one thing, and that is government spending. The public sector government is looking for more revenue, so it is not unfair or unreasonable to ask, how much revenue do we need? What will it be used for? What are the benefits and detriments of this policy? Increased taxes, by how much? How much are they, the wealthy, already paying? What are the short and long-term consequences of this action? What does history show us? The bottom line is, how competitive or uncompetitive do we want to be as a state or a nation? We oppose this proposition of increasing taxes on the wealthy because of the actual results of this action. Not more jobs, but fewer. Decreased private sector investing, reduced consumer spending by the wealthy, decreased charitable contributions. Many of the wealthy are mobile. They can and will move. Between 1998 and 2008, 1.7 million New Yorkers relocated out of state, taking their wealth and talent with them, mostly to Florida and Texas. They are a dynamic and transient group. Over time, a significant portion of the people in this category are not the same year after year. And there are significant unintended consequences. The small business story is one of the most compelling stories of unintended consequences from my perspective. This is not just rhetoric, it has already taken place here in New York State. Small businesses are American heroes. They risk everything for the opportunity to employ people and grow a business. At the start, they finance their businesses with second mortgages, spending down their retirement accounts, their savings accounts, loans from relatives, and maxing out their credit cards. Banks rarely give money to a business startup. It's a critical fact for you to understand that unincorporated businesses in this country pay their state and federal income taxes through their personal income tax returns. That means all the mom-and-pop businesses, the DBAs, the partnerships, the LLCs, and OIS corporations file through their personal income tax return. The SBA tells us that 99.7% of all employer firms in this country are small businesses, and most of them are unincorporated. The U.S. Treasury Department reports that half of the income earned by businesses who pay their taxes through their individual income tax code and have employees would pay the millionaire's tax. This proposal, if enacted at the federal level, will remove $450 billion over the next 10 years from the private sector. Our small businesses compete beyond our region. They compete with other businesses in other states and in other countries, many of which have lower tax rates. Reducing the incentive for small businesses to add new workers and to grow. A business could decide not to grow any further, to manage their business to stay below a personal threshold in order to decrease their tax exposure. They could just keep their business the size it is. So what's the real story that happened here on Main Street in our region 3 years ago? Tom Galisano and Rush Limbaugh were not the only wealthy people who left New York State 3 years ago. In our own community, four businesses that I know of One small business decided he would retire, so he just shut his business down and retired because it was no longer worth his effort to try to stay in business. Another business shut his business down, let his employees go, and he went and got a job. Another person who had run a family business here for several decades moved his family out of state to Florida. Another person I know who had grown his small business by his bootstraps from nothing as a single father, had put his son and daughter through college and had taken them into his business, who does business all over the world, decided it was time for him to leave New York, though he'd lived here most of his life. According to the SBA and census data, of 27.1 non-farm small businesses in the United States, 67% are women or minority owned. That's 18.2 million businesses. 65% of married couples with incomes above $200,000 and 50% of individuals with incomes more than $200,000 report income in their personal income tax returns, according to the Heritage Foundation. Small businesses account for half of private sector jobs and 70% of new jobs. As someone said, you can't love jobs and hate the people who create them. So what is to be gained from bleeding our small businesses? To raise their prices? That's inflation. Reduce their workforce, reduce their benefits to their employees, take a pass on providing better health care for them, or do they close their doors? According to the U.S. Small Business Administration, small businesses pay 44% of the U.S. private payroll, generate 65% of net new jobs over the past 17 years, create more than half of the non-farm private gross domestic product, hire 43% of our high-tech workers. It's not just big business that hires scientists, engineers, computer programmers, and others. There are 52% are home-based and 2% are franchisees. They make up 97.5% of exporters and produce 31% of the export value as of fiscal year 2008. And they produce 13 times more patents per employee than large patenting firms. And small businesses spend more time trying to comply with regulations at the state and federal level, and they're not able to provide health and benefits at the same cost as larger businesses that are able to self-insure. So for that particular reason, the small businesses who are the engine of the American economy, it would be obviously detrimental to subject them to higher taxes.
Speaking now in favor of the proposition to increase taxes on the wealthy is Len Berman. He holds the Moynihan Chair of Public Affairs at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship.
I should specify at the outset that my focus is going to be on federal taxation because that's what I work on and not specifically about state taxes. And I think the proposition is whether taxes on the wealthy should increase. And the main, at least one area where this is playing out is at the federal level. Unless we decide that we want a radically downsized government, taxes on the wealthy have to increase. Federal taxes are at their lowest levels since 1950. That was before the interstate highway system and Medicare and scores of other programs we rely on. And that was before most of the baby boomers were even born. Now the boomers are retiring, which will put unprecedented pressure on federal and state budgets. If we are to avoid bankruptcy, taxes must increase. And it would be absurd to argue that the wealthy should not pay more. Jennifer made the religious and ethical argument for progressive taxation. I'd like to briefly comment on that. In a democracy, we collectively make the rules. We could have anything from a capitalist system to a bunch of kibbutzes or something in between. As an economist, I'm in awe of the prosperity produced by a free market system. But nothing in theory or in practice guarantees that prosperity is widely shared. A progressive tax system can help to mitigate the inequities that are the Achilles heel of unrestrained free enterprise. It's not class warfare to argue that the rich should pay more. In fact, it's quite the opposite, because if we can't figure out a way to share our awesome productivity with the bulk of Americans, they will opt for a different system, and likely one in which rich and the middle class are all worse off. Having made the argument for a progressive tax system, the next question is whether it should be more progressive than at present. Are the wealthy overtaxed? The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has compiled tax and income statistics from 1979 to 2007, just before the financial market meltdown. Over that 28-year period, the share of income going to the top 1% more than doubled, from 10.5% to 21.3%, while their average federal tax rate, including individual and corporate income taxes, excise taxes, and payroll taxes, fell by more than 20%, from 37.3% to 29.5%. During that same period, the share of income going to the middle 60% fell by a similar amount. Their tax burden also fell, but by much less. Capital gains tax rates, which are much in the news because of Governor Romney, are at the lowest level since the Great Depression. Capital gains make up half of millionaires' incomes, while middle-class wages are taxed at much higher rates. That's how Mr. Romney was able to pay an average federal income tax rate of less than 15% in 2009. Some imply that the difference between rich and poor is primarily a matter of effort. The rich work really hard. If the rich got there because they work hard while the rest of us are slackers, they should be able to keep their riches. But it's simply not true. Sure, many rich people work hard, but a lot of lower-income people work really hard too, often in multiple jobs. The rich are rich in no small part because they are lucky. They are especially smart or can jump higher or they were in the right place at the right time. It is implausible that wage disparities of hundreds or thousands of times solely reflect differences in effort. As I mentioned before, economic inequality is at the highest level since the eve of the Great Depression. Now, if economic mobility in the United States were high, maybe inequality wouldn't be a concern since everyone would have a similar chance at success. But that's patently not the case. Children of rich parents are much more likely to grow up rich than children of lower-income people. Rich kids have access to better schools, they live in safer communities, and when they grow up, they have better connections to help them succeed. Progressive taxation is not the sole solution to extreme economic inequality in the U.S., but it can mitigate its effects. We should also invest more in education, for example, but progressive taxation helps. We should care about extreme inequality even if we didn't feel compassion for struggling middle-class families. There's evidence that very unequal economies grow slower than economies with less skewed income distributions. This may be because inequality provokes demands for regulations, trade sanctions, and other provisions that are inimical to growth, or it may be that workers in less equal societies are less productive because they feel alienated. Our distinguished opponents have argued that raising tax rates would stifle job creation and slow economic growth. That's not consistent with the evidence. When President Clinton pushed through tax increases and spending cuts to try to tame the budget, successfully as it turned out, critics from the right predicted a prolonged economic downturn. It didn't happen. The economy flourished. Naysayers warned of disaster when President Reagan supported tax increases in 1982 and 1984. The 80s turned out to be pretty successful as well. And as we know, the unending series of Bush tax cuts did not usher in a period of prosperity. This certainly doesn't prove that economic growth is independent of tax rates. I don't believe that to be the case. But it does suggest that other factors are far more important. As for job creation, it's certainly understandable that people would be preoccupied with jobs right now. But taxes are not why businesses aren't hiring. Hiring is sluggish because demand is still weak. Companies won't gear up production until federal, state, and local government, Companies won't gear up production until they can sell more. And if a lack of revenue means that federal, state, and local governments continue to cut programs and lay off more workers, the economy will suffer. Small businesses, a couple points. One is the vast majority aren't in the top tax brackets. They're not the people we're talking about here. It is true that most of the income produced by small businesses, or about half of the income produced by small businesses, is produced by actually large, successful businesses. But higher tax rates make self-employment more attractive. When you're self-employed, you can deduct all sorts of expenses that you can't when you work for another business. There are other reasons as well. Moreover, taming the deficit would do much more for small and large businesses alike by keeping interest rates from spiking, which would make it very hard for businesses to invest, for people to buy their products, than modest increases in taxes. More importantly, it's important to be clear that the proposition we are debating is not that we should raise tax rates, but that we should raise more revenue from the rich. We can do that by closing loopholes and eliminating unwarranted tax subsidies that disproportionately benefit the rich. That makes the economy work better because we don't waste as many resources on inefficient tax shelters. The bipartisan Bowles-Simpson Commission proposed such a plan, as did the bipartisan Policy Center Task Force on which I served. Such a tax reform will help us forestall bankruptcy as a nation and make the tax code fairer and more conducive to economic growth. We should do that.
You're listening to the Campbell Debates on WRVO, taped earlier at the Everson Museum. The question is whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. Speaking in the negative is State Senator John DeFrancisco. He's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee.
I'm sure everyone, when they walked into this room, already had a preconceived notion on this issue that we're debating tonight, whether the taxes should be increased on the wealthy. It's almost impossible not to have had one in view of the debate that's been going on. It seems ad nauseum. The debate's been going on in New York for several years, and we did, for a period of time, over my negative vote, did raise a surcharge on a tax against the wealthy. And unlike what my worthy opponent just said, the tax rate for the wealthy was $200,000 for a family of $200,000, and then you're in the highest tax bracket with a surcharge attached to it. So it does affect small businesses and it affects jobs. But since everyone came in here with a preconceived notion, and I would guess that most would be for the concept the wealthy should be more taxed, pay more tax. And the reason is pretty simple. Every poll says the same thing. Well, as long as the person who's answering that poll question understands that they're not in that category and someone else is going to take on a greater burden, why not be for it? Why not be for it? So under those circumstances, you see public opinion polls and the political debate where candidates are trying to line up, are we with the 99% or this horrible 1%? The fact is, that's a political debate. We're here under the auspices of Maxwell School, which should be talking about policy that helps create jobs. A good policy is one that makes people move up the ladder and have an incentive to move up the ladder, not let someone else take care of their particular burden. Now, we want justice. We want justice. We do have a heart. We do have a heart. And in creating justice, we do have a progressive tax. So you want a progressive tax? We've got a progressive tax. Let me tell you what the tax structure is in this country. First of all, half of the people in the United States do not pay federal income taxes. Approximately half of the people in the state of New York do not pay state income taxes. The people making over $1 million a year in New York State pay 33% of the taxes. 13.2% of the taxes are paid in the federal government. 13.2% of the people pay 70% of the taxes on the federal tax rate. 13.6% of the people pay 70% of the income taxes, 77% in New York State. Now, if that isn't progressive, I'm not quite sure what is. So there is a progressive tax rate, and the issue is simply tonight whether we tax the wealthy more. And I submit that, first of all, we should not be having a debate that divides the country. We should be all in that boat rowing in the same direction. And secondly, we should not be pitting those people that are taking the risks to start businesses, to create jobs so that those people maybe on the lower end of the economic scale aren't receiving unemployment for 99 weeks. They have a job that they can take, and that job is something that they can be proud of and move up the ladder like everyone else. So the point is, we do have a progressive tax, we do have a heart, and listen to this. Not only do we have a progressive tax rate, but we will have what's called an earned income tax credit in the federal government and the state government as well. So if you are a low-income individual and you have a tax liability, the state earned income tax credit offsets your liability for what you otherwise would have to pay in tax. In addition, and you may not have focused on this, the state of New York will send you a check if you don't use all your earned income tax credit. Last year, the state of New York sent out $930 million worth of checks for people who had the earned income tax credit because of their low income that was over and above what offsetted their taxes that they were otherwise be paid. We do have a heart. The federal government has the same program. In fact, the state modeled their program after the federal program. The federal program last year sent out checks of $110 billion with a B to people whose tax credit was over and above to offset their federal income tax. So the point is, we should not increase the tax on the wealthy, because at some point, Atlas is going to shrug. And when Atlas shrugs, and those people that are creating the jobs and are being treated to the point where they don't want to go, whether they leave the state or whether they close their business, they retire early, whatever it may be, those jobs are not going to be there. And it's no coincidence, I submit, that now we have the lowest interest rate in my lifetime. We have had stimulus money that was spent substantially throughout the federal government in order to try to create jobs, despite the fact that the interest rate is so low, nobody could sell a house. Nobody could sell a house. Banks aren't lending money. People aren't putting their money at risk. And if they're not putting their money at risk, then we're going to end up with the next Steve Jobs staying in his garage, because he won't be able to get the capital he needs to start that business and grow that business. Or maybe someone else might stay a salesman in an automobile dealership rather than taking the risk to be really huge. So, ladies and gentlemen, I would just urge you, even though you may have come in here with a preconceived notion, we do have a progressive tax. We provide cash checks to individuals with low income, the earned income tax credit. We do have a heart, but we can't let those producers that create the jobs lose their heart and back out of the system and stay home. Because then the people we're most concerned about from the biblical references will be hurt the most. Thank you.
Now speaking in favor of the proposition to increase taxes on the wealthy is former governor and attorney general and former CNN host Elliot Spitzer.
I am going to take the privilege of following the senator in one regard, and perhaps only one regard, and that is in standing. Two small points to begin. One, we've never challenged the notion you have a heart. We really haven't. It may beat a little slower. It may not get as excited at the right moments, but we've never challenged the notion that you have one. The second point is a more serious one, and you repeated what is really a canard. And I hope, if nothing else is learned tonight, nobody leaves tonight believing this notion that because 47% of the American public does not pay income tax, that they do not pay taxes. Notice how carefully the folks on the other side elipped those words. They don't pay income taxes. Yes, we've created a somewhat, and I'll get to the progressivity of our income tax in a moment. They don't pay income taxes because we've intentionally said if you have income below a certain threshold, you should not. But you pay sales taxes. You pay property taxes. You pay excise taxes. You pay every other sort of tax, and in its most fundamental structure, when you look at all the numbers, and Len has put many numbers together, he has charts, he's an economist, he'll put you to sleep with so many numbers, but let me tell you the one that matters. We have an income tax and a tax system across the board where you pay a tax that is almost directly proportional to the amount of income you earn. The top group pays taxes roughly proportional to what it earns. If it is progressive, it is hardly so when you include the entirety of the tax burden. We must appreciate that and never forget it. Now, let me argue for the overarching proposition here. Taxes on the wealthy should be raised. And as Lynn pointed out, and I don't mean to dismiss Jennifer's argument but not referring to it, the theological argument is the most important. It is who we are, what we believe in, what we care about, and I think she made it exquisitely. I, being the sort who likes numbers more, I'll focus more on the economic part of it. But let me say this very clearly. If we don't raise taxes in Lend Senate, if we don't raise taxes on the wealthy, we will never have the nation we believe in. It is our purpose. It is our common bond. It is the fabric of what we believe in. I want to go back to Winston Churchill for a moment. Winston Churchill, at the height of World War II, when Britain was being attacked, had one of the most eloquent sayings, and I'll quote it directly. He said, "Never was so much owed by so many to so few." Great words describing the great military feats of the British Air Force protecting against the German invasion. Unfortunately, we have a tax code that is the absolute opposite of that. Never has so much been done by so many for so few who need so little. Think about it. Mitt Romney paid 14%. Now, let me be clear. I don't begrudge Governor Romney the 14% he paid. It is absolutely proper, ethical, legal. He did what is right. But I think now that it has been become the centerpiece of a conversation, let's ask ourselves the question, is that the system we want and the system that is best? And I think it is almost impossible to come to the conclusion that that is where we should be going. Now, I want to argue a very narrow proposition. In the best of all possible worlds, I would argue for raising the marginal rates on the wealthy from 35 to back where they were when President Clinton raised it up to 39 or so. We can afford it. Those who can pay it, including I, would be just fine. But for tonight's purpose, to win this at a tactical level, tonight's debate, I'm going to suggest to you we should raise the tax rate on capital gains so we equate capital gains with ordinary income. That's all we need to do. That's it. Now, if we do that, if we agree to do that, our side of the proposition wins. We will be raising a lot of money from the wealthy. But I want to address this through three different arguments. The first is kind of philosophical. And our politics today, and we've been arrayed this way, our politics today is Rawls versus Nozick. I don't know if this is too abstract. John Rawls, one of the great philosophers of the past 50 years, they both are. These are really the two luminary philosophical voices of the past 50 years, defining different worldviews. John Rawls said, we have to take care of the least well-off member of our society. That's what we are as people, caring human beings. He had a brilliant treatise that discussed it. I'm not going to get into that. John Rawls believes in a progressive tax system. John Rawls believes we should raise our taxes on those who are in the world of the Mitt Romneys, the Governor Romneys, who are paying 14%, not the 35% that others are paying. If you believe in Rawls, I can stop right there. If you believe in Rawls, you're with us, right? You're going to vote for us. Take it on faith. Please do. If you believe in Nozick, the great libertarian, and by the way, I think Atlas has already shrugged. I think Atlas has given up on this, on us, but that's a separate issue. If you believe in the Nozick worldview, and he said taxes are theft. He didn't really mean taxes are theft. He understood public goods. We need a defense. We need parks. But he believed we should all contribute equally. That's the word, equally. He didn't say the rich should pay less. He didn't say, I want a capital gains rate so Mitt Romney pays 14% and Warren Buffett pays 14%, but if you actually earn through sweat and labor and paid an hourly wage, you pay up to 35%. He didn't believe in a regressive tax. Remember, what has been the rallying cry of the right for the past 15 years? A flat tax. So for tonight alone, I'll say, okay, I'll concede the point. Give me a flat tax. Bring Mitt Romney up to the rest of us. That's all I want. Make it flat, please. Now, what could the argument against this possibly be? And I don't want to preempt your side, but maybe, but only if you could somehow persuade me. We've heard a lot about the job creators, right? If you could somehow persuade me that if we were to raise the capital gains rate back to the ordinary income rate, suddenly we would see the end of job creation, and then you'd actually have a Rawlsian argument over intertemporal justice and all that, then maybe I'd say, okay, we have to think about this. But you know what? Kind of like the communist theoreticians who said, you know what? You're right in practice, but you're wrong in theory. Their theory may be good, but it's wrong. It doesn't work. It simply isn't the case, and Len could go on for hours. Trust me, I've heard him, about why they're simply wrong. Sorry, Len, he's on my team. Sometimes people on my team didn't always think so. It's simply not the case. So even if you believe in Nozick, you can't possibly believe that those who are wealthier should pay a lower tax rate. Now, I said I was going to address three different, the political, the economic. The economic one I did in the sense briefly with Nozick. I see my time is done. I hate these cards. Let me make one last point nonetheless, if I might. Can I indulge for 30 more seconds?
The Nozick got you in trouble.
Okay, Nozick got me in trouble. I talk about Nozick, I get excited. See, we have hearts on this side. The difference is this. Let's talk politics for a minute. I don't mean the politics of November. I don't mean the politics of President Obama giving a State of the Union, proposing the Buffett rule. I mean the politics of who we are as a nation. I mean the politics of a nation that right now is being torn asunder, whether it's the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street, by the anger that is being generated by inequity, frustration, a sense that we are no longer part of one community. We are part of one community when we share burdens together. What better way to share burdens together than for everybody, whether you earn $50 million or $200,000, to pay the same rate? As I said, for tonight, I'll give you your flat tax. Just don't give the rich a lower tax. That's all we need. Thank you.
That was former Governor Eliot Spitzer arguing in the Campbell debates. The final speaker in the opening statements, and speaking against the proposition to increase taxes on the wealthy, is Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Hassett was also an economic advisor to the George W. Bush and John McCain presidential campaigns.
The proposition before us, ladies and gentlemen, is that the Assembly would increase taxes on the wealthy. Now, the first thing I can say about the case that's been presented to you is that if this were actually an Oxford debate, and these are Oxford debate rules, then we would win right now. And the reason is that the opposition has made absolutely, or the government, the honorable government, has made no case consistent with the proposition. The proposition said we should raise taxes on the wealthy, and what they've done is they've deflected the proposition to talk about raising taxes on income. Taxes on income are not taxes on the wealthy. Taxes on the wealthy are taxes on wealth. I could have lost $500,000 last year and then made $150,000 this year. I'm still in deep trouble. I'm not wealthy. Okay, taxing income, taxing wealth, they're different things. They've conflated the two. It's a logical error. If we were at Oxford, they would lose right now. They would. But that's not why I ask you to vote against them today. That's not why. That's just the first point. The second point I would like to raise is that we have right now an extremely unethical and indefensible income tax code. On that, I absolutely agree with my honorable members of the government. But the reason that our income tax code is unethical is really a lot different from the case that's been made by those on that side. The reason that our income tax is unethical is that our income tax taxes only the top half of the income distribution. And when we have distributional debates like we're having right now, then really what we're talking about is moving taxes around between, say, the guy in the middle and the guy in the top, or the guy in the 70th percentile and the guy in the top. And, you know, one reason why, perhaps, that the income tax code has evolved to the point where the guy in the middle doesn't pay income tax is that the guy in the middle is the median voter. If you make him happy, he'll vote for you. But look at who loses. Okay, I think, I've studied this a lot, the honorable tall member over there. I understand, by the way, that the Syracuse Orangemen are in need of a big man in the middle. But who is it that suffers? So I think that the high income tax causes a lot of economic damage, and I can cite a million papers. I can put you more to sleep than him. I will assert that. And it causes a lot of economic damage. The honorable member over there might think that it doesn't cause a lot of damage, but he knows that higher marginal rates cause some damage. Let me tell you, if we harm the economy, it's not the rich guy who's going to suffer. It's the guy at the bottom. It's not the guy in the middle of the income distribution who's going to be the first one to lose his job. It's the guy in the bottom decile. And so what we have right now is an intellectually indefensible income tax that moves income around in the top half and makes the guy in the bottom suffer. He's the one that's going to lose the job. Now, the honorable member on the other side said that he's a Rawlsian. Well, Rawls says that we should put first the guy at the bottom. And I put to you that if we put first the guy at the bottom, then we would not accept the damage from these high marginal rates while we pander to the median voter. Now, you would be absolutely correct and wholly right to look at that point and say, that's why I'm going to stand with them. But that's not why I want you to stand with us today. That's just my second point. Now, the economists have studied, folks like us, the optimal income tax for many years. And the optimal income tax, we all agree, taxes consumption and not income. And the reason that the optimal income tax taxes consumption, not income, is that workers need capital to be productive. If they have more capital, their wages go up. This was made most vivid in a book that I edited a while ago, a chapter written by Greg Mankiw from Harvard University, where he set for himself the following challenge. He is hired by the workers of a country to set the tax code, and they can set the tax code anywhere they want because they have a majority, and he has to set the tax on capital. He has to set the tax on capital not to maximize social welfare, the capitalists are irrelevant, just to maximize the welfare of the workers, a much narrower problem than the typical economic problem. And he showed that for that problem, the optimal tax on capital was zero because the capitalists brought in lots of machine, the workers were more productive, their wages went up. And so every economist knows that we need to tax consumption, not income. We need to not tax capital because we need to lure it here, let it create jobs, and drive wages up. So you would be wholly right to vote with us because you understand that the vast majority of economic papers ever written say that our code is astonishingly out of whack with economic theory, but that's not why I want you to vote with us. That's just my third point. If you look at the change in the income distribution over time, the really striking thing is that the income distribution didn't really change much for about 1,000 years. And if you track, as Xavier Sala y Martin at Columbia University has, the income distribution, the path of the Gini coefficient over time, you see a clear statistical break where all of a sudden world income inequality started to plummet, and that break is in 1980. The number of people around the world that live below a dollar a day, the World Bank's poverty level, is lower now by about 70% than it was in 1970. It's all plummeted, Sala y Martin writes, because of the spread of capitalism. Think about what's happened in China to the vast underclass that now all of a sudden has a middle-class income. The spread of capitalism is perhaps the greatest force providing superior welfare, increased welfare for the poor in American or world history. And to slow capitalism by creating a war against the capitalists, as the government would say that you should, is to undermine this force. Now, you would be wholly right to look at that trend and to look at Sala y Martin's work and to say, well, that's why I'm going to stand with them. But that's not why I want you to do it. That's just my fourth point, and I've got a minute, but actually a little more than that. The fact is, I'm going to drop my fourth point because I'm running out of time, but I'm going to go to the fifth. The fact is that the world is flat now. And the reason that we need to have low taxes on capital is the capital can go somewhere else. And if the capital goes somewhere else, our workers don't have it to work with. Somebody else's workers do. Their wages go up, not ours. And in this flat world, it's not just capital that's mobile. You know, if you look around, you'll see many people in this audience that are not American citizens. People come from all over the world to Syracuse University to get advanced degrees because they know that this is one of the best universities in the world. Now, there was a recent study that found that H-1B visas in the United States, H-1B visas that allow these people with high education to stay here and work, have had a very dramatic impact on job creation. And indeed, that for every H-1B visa, looking at geographic variation, every H-1B visa that's granted, five jobs are created in that region. So the reason that I really want you to vote with us today is that there are a lot of people with high incomes and high educations that we need to stay here to help create jobs. And that if we create an unfriendly environment, not just for capital, but for human capital, then we're not going to have the economy that we like. You know, the fact is that it is our sacred obligation. It is absolutely morally incumbent upon us to defend capitalism. And that is not the position that those on that side of the house have taken. What they would do is return to the world of the 70s, where capitals were pitted against wages and pitted against workers. But the fact is that what we need to do is encourage capital to come here, to recognize the vast economic literature that says that capital should be taxed at low levels, and to understand that that means that every now and then we're going to have people like Warren Buffett that pay less tax than their secretary. But that's the system we buy, and we buy it because we understand that capitalism is the biggest force for eliminating poverty in world history, and we support it for that reason. That's why you're going to stand with us. Thank you.
You've just heard the opening statements in this Campbell debate on WRVO, recorded on February 1st at the Everson Museum in downtown Syracuse. The debate's proposition: this assembly would increase taxes on the wealthy. The panelists were Jennifer Hamlin Navias from May Memorial Unitarian Universalist Church in Syracuse, Deborah Warner from Center State CEO, also in Syracuse. Len Berman from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. New York State Senator John D. Francisco. Former New York Governor and Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. And Kevin Hassett from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Here's what's ahead in the second hour. Each team will respond to and rebut the arguments they've heard from the other side. Then the Everson audience gets involved. They will frame questions and make arguments of their own, and the debaters will respond to them and to each other. Following the debaters' closing arguments, the members of the audience register their opinions by walking out one of two doors, one in favor of the proposition and one against. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations and moderator of the debate. You're listening to the Campbell Debate on WRVO. We'll have more after the break. Welcome back for this second segment of the Campbell Debates. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO and the moderator of the debate that you've been listening to. On February 1st, six debaters in a packed house auditorium gathered at the Everson Museum in downtown Syracuse to argue the following proposition. This assembly would increase taxes on the wealthy. Arguing in favor of the proposition were Jennifer Hamlin-Navias from May Memorial Unitarian Universalist Church in Syracuse, Len Berman from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University, and former New York Governor and Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Against the proposition were Deborah Warner from Center State CEO in Syracuse, New York State Senator John D. Francisco, and Kevin Hassett from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. In the first segment, we heard from each speaker about why we should or should not increase taxes on the wealthy. Among the issues of contention that emerged were, should we be talking about a tax on wealth or on income? How progressive is our current tax code, all things considered? Senator John D. Francisco noted the progressivity within the income tax system, while Elliot Spitzer pointed out the other more regressive taxes that those who are less well-off pay, and singled out on the other side of the coin the low capital gains tax. Is there a basic moral imperative that should guide our thinking? Jennifer Hamlin-Navias called for a justice embedded in generosity and a concern for the less fortunate, and Len Berman argued that the future solvency of the nation requires a higher tax on the wealthy. But Kevin Hassett advanced a moral duty to defend and support capitalism as the best way to end poverty. Who gets most helped and hurt by changing the current system? Deborah Warner expressed concern for small business owners. And just how does the economy really respond to higher taxes on the wealthy? It depends on where and when you look. And what next follows, you'll hear each team's attempt to rebut the other side. We begin with the affirmative, and each team member will speak, beginning with Len Berman, followed by Elliot Spitzer, and concluding with Jennifer Hamlin-Navias.
I was actually willing to give Grant a little bit of slack. You know, it is true that tax on wealth is not exactly the same as tax on income, but if you make a more progressive income tax, you will have a more progressive wealth tax on wealth. If you really want a wealth tax, we can talk about that. I don't think it's practical, but I'm happy to know that Kevin Hassett would like an annual wealth tax. But though it doesn't seem entirely consistent with his call for a consumption tax, the thing that my honorable opponents are in denial about, and I think it's actually a lot of people who are against tax increases under any circumstances, is that we have to pay our bills. And if we don't pay our bills, we will go broke. And we're raising vastly less revenue than we need to pay for the government, even not counting the additional spending trying to get the economy out of recession. And the demands on the government are going to grow over time. You might imagine that we're going to slash Medicare, we're going to slash Social Security, we're going to slash Medicaid as a way to deal with the budget. But it's just not going to happen. We're going to need to raise more revenue. And you know, my honorable opponent talked about how we have an earned income tax credit that actually provides checks to low-income people. That's actually a good thing. Low-income people have been, along with the middle class, have been in a 30-year recession. The market wages aren't coming close to keeping pace with their expenses. And providing a subsidy for work, and that's what the earned income credit is a perfectly sensible way to mitigate that unjust and unsustainable market outcome. I don't believe that my opponents are saying that we should raise taxes on the people who are getting the earned income tax credit. They don't have the money. We could rate, even if we wanted to raise taxes on low and middle income people, you know, it's the Willie Sutton thing, you know. Why do you rob banks? It's because that's where the money is. You can raise taxes on middle income people all you want. There's not much money there. Our income distribution has gotten so skewed that the vast majority of wealth and income is concentrated in a tiny sliver of society. What they're arguing for is classic trickle down. That, you know, if we try to tax the rich, that ultimately it'll affect low income people. That's never been true. We've always had taxes higher than what they've been over the last 10 years, and our economy did really well. It's actually a good thing. We don't need a perfect tax system for the economy to grow, because we've never had one, and we won't. Furthermore, we can make the tax system more progressive, as I mentioned, without raising tax rates. We could even do it in a consumption tax. My honorable opponent has colleagues who are writing a book about what's called the X tax, which is a progressive consumption tax. So if you really want that, we could have a tax system that doesn't tax savings and raises more revenue from the wealthy. The other thing is moving part way, even if you decided that you didn't want to tax savings, the idea that we should have a tax system where capital gains is taxed at a 15% rate and other income at a 35% rate, they say, well, that's moving part way towards our ideal consumption tax. It doesn't work. What happens is it creates an enormous bounty for converting ordinary income into capital gains. And an enormous amount of resources go into exploiting that using tax shelters. You have all of these really, really smart people who spend their time coming up with ways to make wages look like capital gains. It works especially well for self-employed people. Those people, if we had a more rational tax system, could actually devote their energies to doing something productive, like, say, figuring out how to make products that other people would want to buy. I think they should. This isn't a war against capitalists. As I mentioned before, you know, what we do through the income tax doesn't determine, is not the only or even the most important factor determining the supply of capital. We've been cutting taxes on savings for 30 years, and our savings rate is virtually zero. And if we run enormous deficits, ultimately that's going to really push up interest rates. We will have a debt crisis, and that would do way more to discourage capital formation than anything we do through the income tax. And I will yield to my honorable colleague.
Well, let me also begin with this notion that somehow they're for capitalism, we're not. I'm a capitalist. And all the years I was attorney general, saying to Wall Street, you are sowing the seeds of the destruction of our economy. They said to me, you, Spitzer, don't believe in capitalism. I said, no, you don't believe in ethics. You don't understand how capitalism works. You are sowing the seeds of the destruction of our economy. And so what I would say to those who look at us and say, ooh, you think the wealthy should pay a bit more in taxes, you don't believe in capitalism, I say, no. We believe in justice. We believe in equity. We understand capitalism. We know how it works. We don't buy the canards of the other side that ethics is antithetical to good products and behavior in the marketplace. And so I'm tired of the attacks from the Wall Street Journal editorial board and the National Review and the AEI and others who say that those of us who have stood for the enforcement of the law are not capitalists. We are capitalists. They are crony capitalists. They are the ones who have led to the destruction of our jobs, our middle class, our housing market, with canards that we must finally be rid of. Because when you listen to an argument being made, most often what is most interesting is what is not said. There was not a single number from the other side that said with any persuasiveness, said at all, that if somehow you made those who believe in equating capital gains and ordinary income, that there would be a drop in job creation. They asserted it, but had no evidence. Not a single fact, because it's not true. As Len told you, you look at the chart of marginal tax rates, when President Roosevelt was our president back in World War II, the top marginal rate was 90%+. It has gone down over the years without any correlation to job creation. None whatsoever. It is a canard that they promote that somehow if you increase taxes and equate capital gains and ordinary income, job creation will cease. I make capital allocation decisions every day. They're wrong. They don't have any data, no proof. Nothing other than dogma that has led to the greatest inequality in income this nation has seen in its modern history. They're wrong. One last point. Ronald Reagan agreed with us. Ronald Reagan believed the capital gains and ordinary income should be taxed the same way. Jennifer?
We have lost our vision of a morality where we take care of the larger community as opposed to greedily trying to protect and grab all that we can on an individual basis. I would call for us to return to a larger vision of morality where we are responsible not simply for my own bank account, but where I am responsible for each one of you in this room as you are responsible for one another.
You're listening to the Campbell Debates on WRVO. The question is whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. You've just heard the debaters in favor of the proposition make their rebuttal. We'll now hear from those opposed. We hear first from Senator John DeFrancisco, then Deborah Warner, and finally Kevin Hassett.
I have no idea what the argument about Wall Street has to do with anything, unless this is an early vision of a new campaign. But the fact of the matter is, what had happened as Attorney General as far as fighting the Wall Street greed, that has nothing to do with the proposition whether we should increase the taxes on the wealthy. And one of the arguments that was raised, we've got to pay for our system some way. We've got to pay for it. Well, when someone loses a job and the economy goes down, what do we do in a household? Do we pay for our system by taking money from a neighbor? Do we pay for our system by taking more wealth from someone else? You cut spending if you have to. We want to be the most generous as we could possibly be. 3 years ago, taxes were increased by $10 billion in the state of New York. Spending was done by $10 billion. That didn't help anybody in the poor. In fact, when the federal stimulus came to us, that came to us, and it was used for ordinary operating expenses, and we come back this last year, and we still got the problems. We have to cut that $10 billion because it's necessary, not because we don't have a heart. We have to tax the rich more because we have to spend more is false. Government has to spend within its means like every other household. And in spending within its means, it means that you have to raise taxes. The issue is, how do you raise them fairly? And I submit that we have an extremely progressive tax. We have a tax that is skewed in favor of the payments by the wealthy. And in fact, the wealthy pay twice. The reason Warren Buffett pays more taxes than his secretary is because Warren Buffett first paid his income taxes on his earned income and then paid a 15% tax for the earnings on the money he already earned. Now, that seems quite, to me, somewhat like a double taxation. Maybe the overall rate goes down, but that's the same thing you're doing when you have a savings account. You're paying twice for earning the money first, paying the tax, and then the earnings from the money that you've already earned has an additional tax. It'll lower the rate, but it still increases the overall taxation. So the proposition should be answered correctly and relevantly. The relevant question is, do we tax the rich more? I submit that should be decided in the negative. Are you going to do it?
We've been focusing a lot on income taxes. I'd like to talk about another tax that we all pay, those of us who are homeowners. Property taxes. Is that a tax on the wealthy? If your house is worth more, your real estate's worth more, you pay a higher tax rate. Indirectly, a lot of that goes to some of the social justice issues we have. In New York State, and particularly in the upstate regions of New York, we pay the highest proportionate property taxes in the entire country. As a percentage of the home you own, you pay a higher rate than almost every other region in the state. Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse, no matter year to year how you arrange the numbers, we're always in the top five. Why is that? For county taxes, the issue is Medicaid. It's more than 40% of your county property taxes. School taxes are the biggest proportion of your property taxes, roughly 70%. Oh, we need to spend more money on education. Yes, we do. But what about some accountability? New York State spends more money per student than any other state in the country. We're spending $20,000 per student per year on average in New York State. What's it cost to go to a community college? But we're getting really poor results. Is it just about the money? Do we need more money? Or does it need to be better spent? On the property tax equation, to think that there are no consequences. There are some safety valves that we have with the STAR program. But for folks on fixed incomes and their value of their property continues to increase, their assessment goes up, it becomes harder and harder for them to keep their homes. It's harder and harder for people to get a home when you can pay down your mortgage, but you'll never pay down your property taxes. They're going to go up every year, unsustainably. That's why we have a property tax cap, because local property taxes have been going up 7, 8, 10% a year. It's not sustainable. And on top of the Medicaid cost, New York State has a $132 billion state budget. More than $50 billion of that cost is Medicaid. We do have a heart. We are doing all of this to help. But another thing about property taxes, for those of you who see the bill, and, you know, we had sales tax going to that. We have a new distribution in our county, and, you know, some towns had been using the money to defer their county taxes. So some folks' taxes went up quite a bit. Some people's county taxes went up 50 and 70% this year. But what's the impact of that on our local economy? Businesses who own real estate have to pay those higher taxes. It's an issue for job recruitment. I have sat in the room with businesses, high-tech businesses in our community, who are struggling to find employees. We have job openings for engineers. We are competing across the country, and people turn down jobs time after time because they look at their property taxes here in New York State and they take a pass and say, I'm going to another state. A recent exec moved to the state of Washington, to Seattle. His property taxes on the same value house are 20% of what they are here. Another person I know moved here from the Washington, D.C. area. His taxes here, same value house, four times what they were outside of D.C., a big, prosperous metropolitan area. So there's another issue. If we want to increase taxes on the wealthy, I would propose that we already are on multiple levels, and it's the property tax problem has certainly gotten to a problem, a crisis.
In May of this year, it was delayed a year because of the tsunami, Japan will reduce its corporate rate, and at that point, the United States will have the highest corporate tax on Earth, except for one small country in Africa. There's ample evidence that this high corporate tax chases jobs offshore. In fact, the average tax in the OECD is about 24%. The average tax after state tax in the U.S. is about 39.5%. The average tax for U.S. multinationals who invest abroad is actually only about 17%, because they don't pick the average other country to invest in. They pick the good one, the best one, the low-tax one. Now, those on the other side would assert that we can look at an economy now that's not creating jobs, that has high unemployment, that's the slowest recovery since the Great Depression. We can look at that, and we can see that we're the place that's chasing capital overseas with the highest corporate tax amongst all developed nations on Earth, and that we can leave the corporate tax where it is, maybe even lift it higher because we want to increase taxes on the wealthy, even though they didn't actually ever address the proposition. We can lift it even higher, and it'll be great. All we have to do is buy a bunch of clunkers, right? If the government jacks up demand, then it'll be great. We can chase the corporations away with a high corporate tax. It's fine. Now, those on that side say they're not anti-capitalist. But I would assert that if you're willing to have the highest corporate tax on Earth, despite all the evidence that corporations' investment is so mobile, if you're willing to chase the jobs overseas in the name of fairness, then I'm not willing to call that capitalism. I don't know what it is, but I'm not. And so they can get angry if they like about that assertion, but I don't see how you can defend being a capitalist if you're willing to be the most unfriendly place to capitalism in the developed world. Now, if you think it's okay, if you think that we're going to create jobs right here in New York State by staying the highest corporate tax place on Earth, then you should vote with them. You should vote with them. And then the honorable member of the other side said, well, what was not said? They provide no evidence. There's no evidence that these tax rates matter. Well, I can tell you that as Mr. Berman will say, that the Handbook of Public Economics, which is the textbook that they teach graduate economics with in almost every graduate program in public finance around the country, has a chapter on the effect of taxes on investment and capital mobility that goes into maybe the 150 papers that document this effect. The chapter was co-authored by Glenn Hubbard of Columbia University and myself.
You're listening to the Campbell Debate on WRVO. The six debaters have just finished their main arguments as well as their rebuttals. Now it's the audience's turn. They'll have a chance to pose questions and make points of their own.
Well, I want to agree with Len Berman that Dr. Hassett is a very effective debater. And I also want to agree with Dr. Hassett that the construal of the question in terms of an income tax isn't exactly the same as the way the proposition is worded in terms of a tax on the wealthy. But I also want to claim that he is guilty of the same problem by restructuring the argument in terms of a consumption tax. And in fact, I think he even went further, because I suspect that the call for a consumption tax actually is, in effect, a call for higher taxes on the poor rather than higher taxes on the wealthy.
Thank you for the remark. Given that they did not address the proposition, then, you know, after addressing the fact that they didn't ever propose, well, no country on earth really taxes wealth directly. So think about, you know, which arguments to address. Now, a consumption tax, which is a tax that's used very much in Europe with a value-added tax, you can have a big amount of consumption at the bottom that you forgive the tax for. So many consumption tax proposals like that being developed by my colleague at AEI says something like the first $20,000 of consumption is not taxed at all, and then you have consumption after that taxed with a higher rate. It's a much, much better system. And it would tax the wealthy a lot, too, because, you know, their wealth is used to consume, to buy jets and things like that.
This is the Campbell Debate on whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. We're now taking questions from the audience at the Everson Museum Auditorium.
I'd like to respectfully suggest that both sides of the panel have avoided the real tax problem, which I see as our bloated military. The Pentagon takes an enormous amount of our taxes. An enormous amount of the Pentagon share gets kicked back to the corporations, the war profiteers. Now, if we could do something about this to make our world a more peaceable world, and our own country and our own government less militaristic, we could cut our taxes enormously. Thank you.
I said earlier we should cut spending. I don't agree with the area you're talking about, but we said we should cut spending. Thank you for agreeing with our side of the proposition.
Let me thank you for raising the issue and saying I do agree with you about where we can cut, and in fact, the president is doing just that. Whether you think it is sufficient is a separate and distinct issue, and as I think we know, we could spend the evening on that. The fact that we have not focused tonight on where we can cut spending does not mean that we don't agree with the other side, that there are areas where we can do so, and we have done so. Medicaid, which is the focus of significant discourse a couple minutes ago, let me tell you, when I was in office, we cut and tried to cut Medicaid spending enormously. But that also is not the issue we are addressing tonight. The issue tonight is, do we need to raise taxes on those who can afford it as a matter of equity, justice, economic principles, and effectiveness of government?
Second member of the team did at one point say, I wrote it down as a quote, that we need to raise taxes because otherwise we will have to cut spending. Now he said cut spending. But he did actually say that. I was sitting right here. I wrote it down.
With respect, I did not say that it's a substitute for cutting spending. I'm saying we can't cut spending enough so that we don't have to raise taxes. If you look at the demographics, population is aging. We're approaching retirement. We've made obligations for Social Security, Medicaid, which pays for half of long-term care, and Medicare, our health care for the elderly. Cutting spending on defense might help in the short term, but when you look at the growth over time, the growth is on those programs for the elderly. And I don't believe that it's possible to get our spending down to 1950 levels, which is what we would have to do to balance budget right now without draconian cuts.
You're listening to the Campbell Debates, and the topic is whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. I'm the moderator, Grant Reher, also host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. We're currently taking questions and points from the audience.
Okay, I would like your thoughts on an idea that might keep both sides happy, What if on the corporate level we didn't tax income and we didn't tax dividends paid out, but we tax the divergence in wage between executive and production level wages? So above a certain multiple, the corporation pays tax on that divergence.
I'll give it a quick shot. Look, it's a great idea. The issue of CEO comp is obviously something we need to think about. I don't think it's actually going to close the gap we're talking about here. If you want to talk about the issue of double taxation at the corporate level through dividends, I think there we actually might have agreement between the two sides, at least I don't want to speak for my colleagues. I think we do need to address that. Perhaps we do want to do something to mitigate the double taxation, but the issue is, should Mitt Romney pay 15% when, let's say, he sells a piece of real estate which has not yet been taxed? That tax should be the same as the income earned by people. Your idea has merit, but I don't think it is sufficient to deal with the numbers we're talking about.
The money that he earned by the property was already taxed. When he sold the asset, then it goes to the capital gains tax for the second tax. So he did pay a tax when he earned the money to buy the property.
Not the differential.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the audience question period and the Campbell debates on WRVO. The debate's proposition: this assembly would increase taxes on the wealthy.
I have a question in terms of, I'm a little confused about capitalism, because Dr. Hassett, you were talking about the fact that if taxes are increased, it will chase companies away and chase capital away. But earlier you said that if capital is here, we'll become more efficient and wages will go up, but it seems like wages have driven companies away to the foreign countries. So which way is it that we can have it so that we're actually employed and that maybe the divide is lessening between income gap?
Thank you for the question, and it's a really good one. The fact is that many factors impact the decision of a multinational to locate its plant in a place that's, say, other than Syracuse, New York, where we really all want it to be. And that includes foreign wages. Something that's really important is intellectual capital protection. So in countries that steal your smart ideas, then people don't want to locate there. So big literature on that. And one of the primary variables driving these decisions is the tax rate. And that's the thing that's easiest for us to affect. We can change that tax rate right now. The evidence is that if we do, then a lot more plants will stay here and foreign companies will decide to locate here. I'm saying that there are many factors, but the tax rate is one of them. There's a lot of evidence that it has a big impact, and that's the thing that we can affect most directly. And so that's the first thing that we need to do. They're saying that we should lift it, either directly. I guess they haven't made the case for the corporate rate, but indirectly with the capital gains rate, it's the same thing. A corporate investment pays both the corporate level rate and the capital gains rate. It's a second layer. This is what my honorable colleague has been saying. They're saying lift the tax on investments here in the U.S.
My honorable opponent keeps on wanting to change the subject. We didn't say anything about raising corporate tax rates. And actually, I don't know what my colleagues believe, but I believe that our corporate tax rates are too high. And our corporate tax system is just a total mess. GE paid little or no taxes, while Walmart pays taxes close to a 35% rate. It makes perfect sense to reform the corporate tax to lower the rate so that it's comparable to that in other countries, and to broaden the base so we don't have all of these opportunities for tax shifting overseas and for loopholes. I'd be very happy to integrate the corporate tax and the individual tax. I think most economists would get a credit for the taxes paid at the corporate level. A lot of corporations don't pay any tax. And having just a blanket differential between capital gains and other income is just the most giant loophole in the tax code. Half of the tax code is devoted to trying to keep people from converting ordinary income into capital gains. And a whole industry is devoted to trying to help them get around that.
I believe that the parties arguing against the proposition indicated at one point that politicians write tax laws in order to chase those of us in the middle for our votes, those of us who vote for them. I would contend, and I would guess I would ask the panels to respond to, that actually the tax code is written to address the needs of the Koch brothers and the others who write the checks that pay for those politicians to run and to run those ads that try to influence and essentially fool many of us to vote for them.
That's actually a really interesting question, because you know the fact is, when you actually talk about reforming the corporate tax, when you talk about integration, a lot of companies are against it, and the reason is that they're actually making money because their tax departments are better than their competitors. GE is notorious for having the smartest tax people in the world. That's not what they should be competing on. They should be competing based on producing products that people want to buy. And the fact is that our tax code is riddled with loopholes that are designed to help one special interest or another. I mean, actually, when we talk about raising taxes, a lot of what we're talking about is getting rid of some spending programs that make no sense. We spend money to, you know, to turn corn into ethanol. Actually, it increases global hunger, raises food prices, and it makes no sense as a matter of policy.
We agree.
Okay. So we'd actually make the tax code more progressive by getting rid of those loopholes.
You're listening to the Campbell Debates, and the topic is whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. I'm the moderator, Grant Reher, also host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. We're currently taking questions and points from the audience.
You could explain to me the logic. I have a small business, employ 26 people, certainly don't consider myself wealthy, and we just finished our year. Now I'm getting ready to pay corporate income tax. And because of the corporate tax, now I'm juggling what I get to spend and invest in next year. I'd like to invest in my IT infrastructure. I'd like to hire some people. I'd like to renovate my building. Corporate taxes are taking a bite out of that. And then whatever's left, then I get to take as income, and I get to pay income tax on that. So explain to me the logic of that.
And then you invest, and you pay capital gains tax on your investment.
No.
Let's hope there's something left to invest.
Sir, I would say you're exactly right, and you're making our point. And here's why. The corporate tax structure, as you've heard in this dialogue in the past few minutes, there's a fair agreement that the corporate tax structure is fundamentally flawed. If you go to Citizens for Tax Justice and read some of their reports, you will see that 280 of the largest corporations in America pay close to zero corporate taxes. They know how, as Lynn said, to game the system. Through avarice, proper or not, they know how to game the system. You pay it. I'm sorry? I'll give you the name of a good accountant. He does Mitt Romney's work.
The accountant was actually put in jail by Elliot before he left the institution.
That's right. That's how I know he's good. You get hit on both sides. You pay a corporate tax, and then when you take back your income, you pay it at the top rate. That's why we're saying somebody who is fortunate enough through the sale of a building, the sale or the possession of a carried interest in a hedge fund or in a private equity firm, to have that viewed as a capital gain, who then pays that at 15%, is disadvantaging you. We're saying, let's be equitable. Let's go back to Nozick. Let's all pay the same flat rate that they wanted. That's why Ronald Reagan supported our view on this.
If I take that and invest it into another, say, a new building, then there's a disincentive for me to take what I might have left and invest it in a new building, because I'm going to get hit again with tax on money that I've already paid tax on.
No, look, as somebody who's in the real estate sector, I can tell you, you take money out, you pay your tax, either you do a 1031 exchange, or I'll give you an accountant who can explain that to you also. but more importantly, once your money is out, then you're back to the level playing field, and then you go prospectively, is your investment decision going to be based upon a 15% or 35%? We're saying equalize that rate.
This is the Campbell Debate on whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. We're now taking questions from the audience at the Everson Museum Auditorium.
I would like to say something. The point that you were just talking about with that gentleman just goes to show you how convoluted and overly complicated our system is, and how there has been so many special interests that have allowed people to have really risen to the top and other people that don't. I know that the other side was talking about Medicaid, which is completely necessary as far as I'm concerned, as far as public health goes. We all need to be taken care of. And I felt that it was kind of a low blow because it really wasn't talking about who really needs to pay more money in that respect. It was more talking about where is the money going. And if the money is going there and people need to be taken care of, then I do believe that that is the responsibility as humanists, that we need to take care of each other and ourselves. I, too, had lymphoma, just like the gentleman on the corner. So I do know what it's like to have to suffer, and I know what it's like to add to the economy by being part of it, and I know what it's like to be taken out of it because of sickness. So I don't think that the top level is paying their fair share due to a lot of, as I said initially, convoluted, overcomplicated things that the general people, like that small business gentleman was talking about. Why is he having to deal with that as a small businessman? Why is that happening to us? And why is $200,000 making you so rich? I'm not talking $200,000. I'm talking millions. People make millions.
One of the reasons why the threshold has been set at $200,000 or $500,000 is government is looking, be at the state level or national level, what the gap is. How much more money do they want to meet this, whatever the spending level is that they're going to achieve? And the reason that it comes down to $200,000 is when you look at the surcharge, what are the numbers plugged in to fill the gap? And that's the income level that it has to come down to generate enough money to fill the gap.
This is not a question about Republicans or Democrats, about President Obama or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan. The fact is that we've not really tried trickle-down in the way that it really matters. We've got very high taxes on capital in our country, and I think that given that everybody else, I mean, look, we could radically improve the situation for capital in our country if we adopted the rates that have been adopted by the Germans or the French or the Swedes. And the reason that they adopted those rates is that they noticed that when they did that, then more capital came to their country and their unemployment went down and people got jobs and wages went up. We've not played that, and it's as much President Bush's fault as anybody else's. He chose to go after the wrong taxes. But, you know, we've not tried it. We need to try it. And if we just increase taxes on the wealthy, then we're not going to create jobs. There's no recipe for jobs that includes increasing taxes on the people who create them.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the audience question period and the Campbell debates on WRVO. The debate's proposition, this assembly would increase taxes on the wealthy.
I'd like to go back to the moral framing of the issue. I recently met a Canadian who was an ophthalmologist, and he said he made, he's an eye doctor, and he made good money. And he said, in Canada, we pay a lot of taxes. And I asked the guy, I said, well, you ever think about moving to the States? So, like, why do you do that? And he says, it's real simple. We've made a decision. We're going to take care of all the people in Canada. And to me, it was so refreshing to hear somebody who, pays a lot of taxes to say, hey, it's real simple. We want to take care of everybody. So for the folks on the right, from my perspective, who are have difficulty with raising taxes on the wealthy, I mean, what income level do you see wealthy or affluent as? Because I hear like 200,000 is too low, and I live in Fayetteville, and most of my neighbors don't make 200,000. So where would you draw the line? What income level? Because 200,000 is too low. They're not wealthy.
Yeah, I don't draw a line. The fact is that on capital, we need to attract it here with really, really low rates. On labor income, then maybe I'm willing to have high rates because labor supply isn't that elastic, and people working here in the country with high wages, they might not be very mobile, so it's not probably causing a huge amount of harm to the economy. But just setting a fixed cutoff point is something that I can't do, because the point is we need to be attractive to capital. We need to stop being the highest capital tax place on earth.
We actually don't have trouble attracting capital in the United States. We have the richest country in the history of the world. We've had robust, on average, economic growth over the last 30 or 40 years. The problem is it's all been concentrated in a tiny, tiny sliver of the population. We have interest rates close to zero. People want to lend money and invest in the United States, notwithstanding the fact that we do have a messed up corporate tax system. We could certainly do better, but we don't have to throw out the whole notion of a progressive tax.
Can I just add one thing? I mean, I think Len is so right. We have $2 trillion plus sitting on corporate banks and corporate coffers. Interest rates at zero. There is not a capital shortage right now. There's a demand crisis. This is Keynes. He was right. When it comes to your point, sir, you are exactly right. What we should do is understand, when we talk about tax and capital gains, if I'm correct, I don't have the chart here, about 85% of the capital gains benefits accrue to those in the top 10% of our income brackets. They are the ones whom we think, as a matter of equity and justice, can afford to pay that differential without having any of the negative economic consequences the other side portends. They're Cassandras. I don't think they're right.
Banks may have resources, but I will tell you that if you are a small business and you are trying to get a loan, it is very difficult. Capital is really tight. It is more and more difficult to get it. and there are banks in our community have turned around and shunned their small business customers and completely gotten out of. We're saying we just don't want you as a customer anymore. You've been a great customer. You've got great credit, but we just don't want you anymore.
The reality is
the capital's not available.
No. The reason for that is that they are hoarding capital to cover the losses they incurred over the past decade of gamesmanship. It's very clear. To be continued.
This is all very interesting, but it's not the proposition. And the proposition is what we've been talking about, and we believe that there is a progressive tax in the state of New York. There is. And since there is, the question is, should we make it more burden on the wealthy or not? And we believe it's in the negative.
You're listening to the first Campbell debate on WRVO. The debate's question is whether to increase taxes on the wealthy. We've just finished the audience questions and points, and we'll now hear each debating team's closing remarks. One member from each team will make a final statement. First, we'll hear from Len Berman. He holds the Moynihan Chair at Syracuse University's Maxwell School, and he's speaking in the affirmative on the proposition. Then, Kevin Hassett from the American Enterprise Institute, and arguing in the negative, will have the last word.
The Congressional Budget Office yesterday put out their annual report talking about what our budget situation is, and they have this beautiful chart on the cover of the report showing what the deficit would be if we hadn't pushed past the Bush tax cuts and what it's actually going to be if we extend the Bush tax cuts over the next 10 years. The Bush tax cuts made the tax code markedly less progressive, and it was the beginning of this whole idea that we basically just don't have to pay for government. The deficits we're looking at going forward are, you know, the economy recovers, and over a short time, the deficits get a little bit smaller, but by the end of the decade, we're running trillion-dollar deficits. We can't afford these tax cuts for rich people. We absolutely should be reforming the tax system to get rid of loopholes, to make it more progressive, or to make it more efficient. We could do that in a way that actually lowers tax rates and increases productivity overall. My honorable opponent just said there was this wealth of evidence that shows that we shouldn't tax savings, we should have low tax rates. I'll just point out that, well, first of all, the theoretical arguments that say that we shouldn't tax savings assume that people live forever or that there's asexual reproduction and that they plan out to infinity, and that then compound interest makes savings really, really important. But that's why people think economists are a little bit out of touch. Peter Diamond, who recently won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and Emmanuel Saez, who won the award we give to the future Nobel laureates, the ones under 40, had an article that said that we should be raising taxes on lower-income people based on this trade-off between equity and efficiency, looking at this inequality over time. And they also argued that, well, okay, people do respond to tax rates, but the way to deal with that is to get rid of all the loopholes to make that possible, rather than just throwing up our hands, giving up, and saying, well, just cut taxes to zero.
Kevin, you or your team has the last word.
I would like to thank my august compatriots. It's been a really exciting and memorable night. I'd like to thank you for coming here and giving us so generously of your time and your ideas. And I'd like to thank I.M. Pei for designing such a wonderful museum. This is the first that he built. This is the first, and isn't it an honor to be here? I think that it's been something of a meandering debate, in part because the yay side, the government side, never really defined their proposition in a precise way. And as we tried to do it for them, because they didn't do it, then they started to concede our points. So now if we listen to them, they're going to cut the corporate rate. I assert that if we cut the corporate rate, guess what? There's going to be some rich people that benefit from that, okay? And so they're conceding the main point because they're wrong. And it might be hard to say, well, they've said so many things, they've conceded so many points. Exactly what have they argued that I can vote on when I choose whether to go out the yay over there where you're going to vote with them so unwisely, or the nay, the nay, the glorious nay that, by the way, has some wonderful wine on the other side of that door. And I've instructed them that everybody who goes out the yay side is a teetotaler. But if you're wondering exactly what is the proposition before us, what's the one thing I can have in my mind as I'm deciding which door to walk out, then I would say, well, let's think about, sir, the small businessman you spoke, what's your name?
Bill.
Okay. So the bottom line is, if you believe that if we increase taxes on Bill, that it's going to be good for Syracuse. I'm serious. If you think we need to increase Bill's taxes because he's exactly the target of their proposal, and if you think that will create jobs, then you walk out the yay and you look and watch as businesses leave and leave our country. That is absolutely what they've argued. They have argued that we're going to tax small businesses, we're going to tax corporations, we're going to increase taxes on people who invest in creating jobs here in the United States. We're going to tax Bill, and it's going to be good for Syracuse, and they've not made that point, and you cannot vote with them. Thank you.
Thank you. Last words. Again, I want to begin where I started, end where I began, and thank the panelists for a great debate, and I think within reason, being mindful of the time. And I want to thank the audience again for attending and contributing. I have a couple reminders and invitations, but first I'd like us all to give the debaters and ourselves a round of applause.
Thanks for listening to the first Campbell debate on WRVO. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations and moderator of the debate. The proposition was, this assembly would increase taxes on the wealthy. The Everson Museum audience voted by walking out one of two doors and reflecting the view that currently exists in the nation as a whole, amplified a bit, in fact, by this audience. The affirmative view carried the evening by a 7-1 margin. This was also similar to the view going into the debate as measured by an anonymous survey. Though many minds in the audience might not have been changed, the debate, I think, showcased two things. There are good arguments to be made all around on this issue, and it's a complicated question. In 2012, Bill, the small business person, may replace Joe, the plumber. To hear the next debate in person, join me, Bill, and another excellent debating team at the Everson Museum on April 26 at 7 p.m. Check out campbellinstitute.org in the coming weeks for more information. Again, for the Campbell debates and for WRVO, thank you for listening.